Despite a better understanding of the genetic, physiological, and environmental factors involved in the sleep-wake regulation, many people still don't get enough sleep. In fact, as many as one-third are not sleeping enough, and that is according to the National Sleep Foundation. One potential reason is the public's lack of information or even misinformation about sleep. In other words, a lot of people still don't believe a lot of the common myths when it comes to getting a good night's sleep. These myths aren't supported by current scientific evidence and are likely subtracting from your sleep health. When thinking about getting the sleep that you need, it's normal to focus on how many hours of sleep you get. While sleep duration is undoubtedly important, it's not the only part of the equation. It's super critical to think about sleep quality and whether the time spent sleeping is actually restorative. So progressing smoothly multiple times through the sleep cycle, which is, by the way, composed of four separate sleep stages, is a vital part of getting truly high quality rest. Each sleep stage plays a part in allowing your mind and body to wake up feeling refreshed and energized. So understanding the sleep cycle also helps explain how certain sleep disorders such as insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea can impact your sleep and your health. This episode is a part two and dedicated to understanding the sleep stage of deep sleep. If you haven't done so yet, I urge you to check out part one, which is titled Three Powerful Ways to Increase Your REM Sleep, so you can get an understanding of the difference between REM sleep and deep sleep. However, in this episode, we will cover what deep sleep is, the main processes associated with deep sleep, and then we'll finish off by digging in deep into some of the things that are blocking you from getting deep sleep. So guys, without further delay, let's get into the episode. Neuroscience, neurology, longevity, and beyond. Learn everything you need to know from the best physicians and experts in the world. The NeuroExperience Podcast is a platform to help you understand what the brain is and how it shapes every part of our lives. Every episode comes to you from highly credible sources. I'm Louisa Nicola, medical neuroscientist from Australia living in New York City. Come and take a NeuroExperience with me. The NeuroExperience Podcast wouldn't be made possible if it wasn't for our sponsors. So I want to take some time now to thank our two sponsors of this episode. The first one is 8 Sleep. If you track your sleep data using an Oura Ring or a Whoop watch, then you probably see your sleep score. However, what do you do after that? Do you know how to get better sleep? Because what I see, guys, is a lot of people on social media posting their sleep scores from their Whoop and their Oura Ring, but they don't really know how to optimize their sleep stages. One sure way to get better sleep is by managing your thermal regulation. I do that every night. I sleep on a performance mattress, and that is the 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover. It is the best investment I've ever made in my health and well-being. Here's how it works. You can order the Pod Pro cover to your and add it to your current mattress. That's what I did. I didn't want to change up my mattress, so I ordered the Pod Pro cover. I wrapped the cover around my mattress, and basically I set the temperature using my phone. So the pod comes with an app. You start sleeping at any temperature you want. Your temperature is actually, you can look at the sleep stages that you go through throughout the night, REM sleep, or you can go falling asleep, REM sleep, deep sleep, waking up stages, and you can actually set the temperature according to your sleep stages. So we know that through science that to fall asleep and stay asleep, our core body temperature needs to drop by at least 2 to 3 degrees. So having a temperature mattress is the best way to do this. The good news for you guys is that you can actually get this for $150 off. All you have to do is visit 8sleep.com/Louisa, go through the checkout and use code NEURO, N-E-U-R-O, to claim this offer. All the links will be below. Our second sponsor is Muse, the brain sensing headband. If you're like me and you've tried to meditate but struggled to settle your mind, then you might want to check out the Muse headset. This headset enables you to use real-time biofeedback on your brain activity to learn how to find calm and let the world melt away. So I started using the Muse headband about 3 weeks ago, mainly because on some nights I just cannot settle my mind down. And I like to do non-invasive things to help calm my mind. And this device literally put me into a calm state. I used the sleep tracking and guided sleep journeys to help me get better sleep. So if you want to try this out, Muse is offering the Neuro Experience listeners a 15% off the device by using code NEURO at checkout. So I will link this below also. So let's get into the episode. Deep sleep, what is it? Before we actually describe what deep sleep is, one thing is very clear that we need to get out, and that is from the moment that you start to fall asleep and stay asleep, your brain cycles through 4 stages of sleep. Stages 1, 2, and 3 are what's considered non-rapid eye movement sleep. Then as you move through the night and you reach stage 4 is rapid eye movement sleep, which is also known as active sleep or paradoxical sleep. If you listen to part 1, you'll understand a bit more about that. So now that we know that stages 1 to 3 are involved in non-rapid eye movement sleep, we now know that that's the part that this episode is going to be focusing on. So we're going to be focusing on the first 3 stages of sleep because that's where deep sleep actually lies. So deep sleep can be described as stage 3 of non-rapid eye movement sleep. And you may hear people often refer to deep sleep as slow wave sleep. And if you listened to the first episode, you would have heard me speak about an EEG and a polysomnography. I always have trouble saying that. It's a sleep study. It's also called a PSG, and I'll refer to it as a PSG. But pretty much this sleep stage is associated with the slowest brain waves. In fact, if you see this sleep stage on an EEG, you will see that it produces slow waves with a relatively high amplitude and a frequency of less than 1 hertz. So these are really, really big, big, slow waves. Now, when we look at a PSG, which is a sleep study, this is where we can typically classify different sleep stages. So we classify REM sleep and deep sleep according to the EEG during a sleep study. Now, when a person is in deep sleep, there are a few things that happen. There are a few things that dictate if a person is in deep sleep. And they are slow or absent eye movements. So when you are in this stage, as opposed to REM sleep, people who are in slow wave sleep exhibit little to no eye movements. Hence, it's characterized as non-rapid eye movement sleep. So that's the first indication to know that somebody is in this sleep stage. The second indication is moderate muscle tone. So the muscle tone during this stage is significantly reduced. Unlike REM sleep, the body is not paralyzed. So during rapid eye movement sleep, the body is completely paralyzed. During slow wave sleep or deep sleep, the muscle tone is significantly reduced. However, you are not completely paralyzed. Now, the third indication that shows that a person is in deep sleep is via EEG synchronization. So this period of sleep is known as slow wave sleep, as I mentioned earlier, because the brain waves are synchronized. So we have different brain waves. We've got alpha brain waves, which I know you've all heard of. We've got beta brain waves. We've got gamma brain waves. But during the slow wave deep sleep stages, the brain produces delta waves, which are slow waves with large amplitudes and low frequency that ranges typically from 0.5 to 4 hertz. So for an average person, slow wave sleep happens approximately 60 minutes after sleep onset. It typically lasts between 20 to 40 minutes in the first cycle and becomes shorter and shorter, and sometimes it completely disappears in the second half of the night. Now, during this stage, what else happens? Well, we know that muscle tone decreases, heart rate and breathing decreases, and we have an increasingly large stimulus that is needed to wake us up. So we're in that really, really deep stage that in order to wake us up, we really need someone to push at us or make a loud noise or make a loud bang. What also is happening is we have reduced brainwave activity, and scientists believe that this happens so we can help conserve brain energy for memory consolidation and the removal of brain wastes, such as toxins that build up during the environment, during our day-to-day activity, etc. I've done a specific episode a few months ago now, which was dedicated to the glymphatic system. Now, this system, if you remember, actually kicks in during the deep sleep stages. So I'm not going to go into the glymphatic system too much, but I really think it's a beautiful system that we all need to know about, and it acts as a sewage system. So one of the reasons why optimizing for deep sleep is really important is because we do get that flush of toxins out of our brain. We do have the ability to go in and restore the function of our brain, consolidate all of our memories during that stage. So it literally, if you can imagine your brain going through a car wash and you've got people scrubbing it, you've got a machine that goes in and clears out all the toxins, that is called the glymphatic system. Like the lymphatic system, but it happens in your brain. It goes through and it cleans out all the debris. Now, it only happens predominantly during deep sleep. So if you have ever woken up and you've had a groggy mind or you've had brain fog, that's probably because you haven't activated the glymphatic system to its fullest. So I'm not going to go into that too much because I've done an episode on that, but I did want to shed some light on that specific system that gets kicked in during deep sleep. Now I want to move on and talk about some of the main processes that happen during slow wave sleep. I already mentioned the glymphatic system kicks in. What else happens during the brain during slow wave sleep? Well, although the brain and the body are most inactive during the sleep stage, the internal body environment is maintained to keep the body functioning through the regulation of hormone secretion. We're going to go in now and talk about two specific hormones that were found to be strongly or particularly associated with slow wave sleep. The first hormone that we're going to discuss is growth hormone. So growth hormone is a hormone that promotes cell and tissue growth in the body. Its secretion is specific to slow wave sleep, and it's strongly correlated with the power of EEG delta activity. In other words, the higher the EEG delta activity, the higher the rate of growth hormone secretion. I think that's really fascinating. So growth hormone also increases glucose production by the liver and kidney to maintain glucose supply for the brain and other tissues such as red blood cells while the body is in a fasting state. So growth hormone is also associated with protein synthesis. So you may be wondering, or you may be associating this with babies. So we know that babies, as they grow, in their very, very infancy, they sleep a lot. They go into those deep, deep sleep stages where you have to make a very loud noise to wake them up. That's Mother Nature's way of secreting massive amounts of growth hormone. So for a healthy baby to grow, it needs a healthy amount of growth hormone, and this is secreted during deep sleep. If you rob somebody of this, and you probably all rob yourselves of this wonderful hormone, because you may be doing things that are kicking you out of the deep sleep stages, this is something to really consider. Growth hormone is especially important for so many cellular repair aspects. So skipping out on deep sleep is just going to leave you behind and basically not give you a head start in your day, but basically push you back. So for those of you who are out there exercising a lot, for all of the athletes listening and for all of the coaches listening, if you want your athletes or if you want yourselves to be recovering well, you really want to optimize for deep sleep so you can get this secretion of growth hormone so it can go through and help you recover better and faster. So that's hormone number one. The second one that we're going to discuss is thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH. So this is a hormone that controls the production of thyroid hormone. And this is suppressed during slow wave sleep. So thyroid stimulating hormone is associated with increased insulin resistance, which the suppression of TSH during slow wave sleep may be a protective mechanism against metabolic diseases such as diabetes. So if you think about it, slow wave sleep can really be defined as the fountain of youth, because growth hormone makes you feel younger and it also makes you look younger. So let's move away from hormones and talk about the link between deep sleep and immunity. Now, while sleep plays a critical role in immune function, the immune system also affects sleep in multiple ways. And a lot of it has to do with deep sleep. So firstly, as a broad overview, infections can trigger various responses from the immune system, including a lack of energy and sleepiness. And this is one of the reasons why people who are sick, or if you've got the flu, you often spend more time in bed sleeping. And the nature of sleep changes during infection as well. So if you've got an infection, it alters how much time is spent in certain sleep stages. Specifically, the immune response induces more time in stage 3 non-REM sleep, which is also deep sleep. So deep sleep involves greater slowing of bodily processes, which we learned above. And when we have a slowing of bodily processes, this allows the immune system to utilize more energy to fight the infection. So it kind of makes sense, right? If you've got an infection or you've got a virus, when you're in bed, you're actually spending more time naturally in the deep sleep stages. So you're able to get your bodily processes lowered, get your brainwave activities lowered, allowing the immune system to utilize more energy to fight infection. So here's another really important finding, and it involves a fever. So a fever is another important immune response. Deep sleep is increased when we're fighting an infection because it's the period of sleep when our metabolism is lowest. It frees up energy to mount a higher fever response. So we learned that already. But it turns out that shivering is a response to a fever and is beneficial in releasing heat. So when we have a fever, we're hot, we tend to shiver, and that's the body's normal response to releasing the heat to bring the fever down. It turns out that our body cannot shiver during REM sleep, because when we're in REM sleep, what do we remember about REM sleep? We know that during REM sleep, we have muscle atonia. Therefore, during an active infection, REM sleep is virtually abolished. So we know that we have decreased muscle tone during deep sleep, but we are not atonic. We're not paralyzed during deep sleep. So therefore, when we have a fever, we spend more time during REM sleep in order to be able to shiver and fight off the fever. I thought that was really interesting. But just on that, I think while researchers continue to study the relationships between sleep and the immune system, these effects demonstrate how closely interlinked they are and how the immune system can harness sleep to improve its ability to fight off infection. It's such a beautiful and natural process. So now that we've gone through that, let's move into some of the things that we may be doing or ingesting on a day-to-day basis that will stop or block our deep sleep. The first one is caffeine. We know that caffeine has a half-life of 6 hours, and it's generally used to block adenosine and keep us awake. But it comes at the cost of slow wave sleep. So caffeine prevents the interaction between the brain receptors and adenosine. Adenosine is a peptide that builds up during wakefulness and makes us sleepy. So this reduces the sleep drive and hence reduces slow wave sleep. And there's been studies to show that having 100 milligrams to 400 milligrams of caffeine, which is equivalent to 1 to 4 8-ounce cups of coffee, intake during 6 hours before bedtime increases sleep latency and decreases EEG delta activity. What does that mean? Sleep latency is the time that it takes you to fall asleep. So if you're having 100 milligrams or 200 milligrams up to 400 milligrams of caffeine 6 hours before bedtime or within that 6 hour time frame of bedtime, you increase your sleep latency. That means you increase the amount of time it takes you to fall asleep and you decrease your slow wave delta activity. So keeping caffeine away from you 6 hours in that 6 hour window before falling asleep is an actionable item there. The next one is excessive daytime naps. So that can be seen as a slow wave sleep blocker. So generally, slow wave sleep is regulated by homeostatic regulation. This means that when a person stays awake, their sleep pressure will continue to build up. And the amount of sleep pressure will then affect the depth and duration of a person's sleep. So daytime naps have been shown to decrease the sleep pressure and subsequently reduce the amount of deep sleep during the night. So this may lead to future health complications as short nocturnal sleep appears to be associated with diseases such as cognitive disorders and mortality. So what does that mean? It generally means that in order to build up sleep pressure at night so you can have a full night's sleep, whether that's 8 hours or 9 hours, to have that, we need to feel pretty sleepy, and you're going to be taking away from the sleep pressure if you engage in regular naps during the day. So last but not least, I'm going to touch on something that I previously discussed in the REM sleep part one episode, and that is the use of medications. So it has been found that medications such as benzodiazepine and opioids have been seen to reduce slow wave sleep. And these are for reasons that I'm not going to go into in this episode, but for example, benzodiazepines bind to GABA-A receptors in the brain, which, you know, this is something that leads to inhibition of neurotransmission and subsequently disrupts the synchronization of brainwave activity. So I'm not saying go out there and stop all medications. Obviously, if you are on them and prescribe them from a physician, this is not medical advice. However, I will say that just in the literature, it has shown that there is disruptions in the deep sleep patterns and also the REM sleep patterns when somebody has been prescribed with psychoactive drugs such as benzodiazepines and opioids. So now that we've got that figured out, guys, let's talk about some ways that you can naturally enhance your deep sleep states. So as we know that deep sleep happens in the first part of the night, we know the benefits of deep sleep. We now know the difference between deep sleep and REM sleep. We know that there are certain things that block us from getting into deep sleep. Let's talk about things that can decrease our sleep latency, which is how can we decrease the time that it takes us to fall asleep? And how can we increase the amount of slow wave sleep that we get? Well, first and foremost, the hours of sleep that you get really matter. So sleeping before midnight has been shown to be most effective. So sleeping for 8 hours, such as going to bed at midnight and waking up at 8 a.m. is completely different than going to sleep at 10 p.m. and waking up at 6 a.m. So if you want to get on a track of decreasing your sleep latency and increasing that slow wave sleep, you want to first try and get to bed at a reasonable hour, which is at least 2 hours before midnight. So if you're planning to fall asleep and be asleep at 10 p.m., you may want to start settling down at around 9:30, maybe even 9:15, get into bed at 9:50 and try and just have a really easy 10-minute or even a 5-minute sleep latency. So that's first thing, 10 p.m. bedtime. A lot of the times people ask me, Louisa, how can I decrease my sleep latency? And oftentimes when we're having trouble falling asleep, it's often because we have a racing mind. We have so many things happening throughout our mind. And that really causes us to lay in bed and keep thinking and keep wondering about the next day or some of life's problems. Now, with a clear medical disclaimer here, I'm not telling anybody to go and add in anything into their diet or take out of it, but something that has been shown in the literature to really help with this is supplementing with an amino acid called GABA, gamma aminobutyric acid. It's our chief inhibitory neurotransmitter. So basically what that does, if you supplement with GABA, it has been shown, and I actually can speak from experience, when I have a racing mind, I have GABA. And what it does is it really slows down the brainwave activity. So it inhibits synaptic transmission. So it really slows down your brain. If you've got a racing mind, I find that supplementing with GABA may help in reducing that sleep latency and really help you fall asleep faster. Last but not least, I usually would say look at your temperature. I speak about that so often. I am a very, very big advocate of looking at thermal temperature. You all know I sleep on a performance mattress. I link my temperature to my different sleep stages. However, this time I would advocate for really having a look at how can you optimize the light exposure in your bedroom or even in your living room, for example. So, I've said it several times, and I'm sure you've heard it several times, that light can block REM sleep and also deep sleep. It can really make you feel awake with the release of cortisol. It can, light exposure at late night times, I would say, can block melatonin secretion. So we know already that light from your TV or your computer can block us from getting into sleep. But how can we optimize for that? Because we don't really want to be walking around in the dark. And something that I have done is I have lamps throughout my apartment now, and the lamps are situated on the floor. And this helps so I don't have direct light above my head, when you have above overhead lighting, that has been shown to activate the cortisol and trigger your brain to say that I'm awake and I'm ready to go. So in order to not walk around your house, in a pitch black environment, the best way that I know from experience is you want to try and get very dim lights. That's the first thing. And then you want to try and place those lights, not overhead, but you want to try and place those lights underhead, below the retina, if you will. The only way to really do that is if you've got lamps around your apartment on the floor. I mean, you could argue that that might be the same as putting candles everywhere, but I really don't want to walk around with candles on the floor. I would most likely trip on one of them and light the place up. So that's another little hack, if you will. If you want to have a look at that, go through and try and place the lamps on the floor to help you decrease the amount of light exposure you have before going to bed. So guys, I hope you enjoyed this part two of the sleep stage process. I hope you're able to not only elicit an understanding of the differences in sleep stages and sleep as a whole, but I hope you're able to get a few protocols from this so you can start to optimize your sleep. These episodes are not made just for the sole purpose of education. They are made as well so you can enhance your sleep fitness, your sleep performance, so you can perform better, think faster, and live longer. With that said, I hope you have an awesome day.